since we were talking about Benjamin Britten, I'll start there instead of Ish. I'm going to do a very short review of yesterday because I think most of you are here. So that keep that very short. Benjamin Britten lived from 1913 to 1976. And this piece was in 1962. So it's he's really at his height of his powers. He's probably one of the best known 20th century English musicians. His reputation is spotty because, if you remember what it was like in the 50s and 60s, it was this highly organized, either chance music or ultra-rational kind of music. And he was still writing things that maybe resembled tunes once in a while, and people might actually like to sing. So he was scorned by the establishment, especially the sort of German-dominated and American university-dominated groups of composers and theorists.
So, when did the Ceremony of Carols get
written? Pardon?
The Ceremony of Carols, when would that have been?
That, I think if I remember correctly, was written when he was returning to England from the United States. So I'll get to that just, I'll show you how it fits in. Well, I'll start there. It's one of his most famous pieces. And he had come to the United States because he was a pacifist, didn't want to fight in the war, and pacifists were pretty much frowned on yet in England, well, in this country as well, probably. So he came to this country and got commissions and did things and worked a little bit with Aaron Copland, actually, wrote a piece that sounds exactly like Aaron Copland that he denied that he ever wrote because he couldn't remember one, but it's obviously in his handwriting, so unless somebody really wanted to fake it, but it's something he didn't remember very much. But he gradually decided he wanted to go back to England and face the tribunal in order to be declared conscientious objector. And so he went back to face that sort of an idea. And he was allowed to be a conscientious objector, but he was to go like to some prisons and present concerts in certain places as his contribution to the war effort. Ceremony of Carols is probably his most famous piece. We have a harp player at St. Olaf who more or less keeps track of every time she's played the piece, like puts a notch on her rifle or a notch on her harp because the piece has done so much. And you can see why. I mean, it's beautiful. But I think he wrote it on the boat back to England from the United States. Hymn to St. Cecilia is another very familiar piece for choirs. Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. Mm-hmm. A lot of you know that in the teaching business. He did things for the BBC and narrator in music, World of the Spirit, a piece that's just been sort of rediscovered and published. I did that St. Olaf a few years ago. It's a lovely piece. The Sinfonia da Requiem is an entirely orchestral piece written in 1940. And he was also noted for writing a lot of song cycles, a lot of them for his partner, Peter Pears. He also wrote a number of operas of all various sorts, more or less kind of comic operas, and the most famous being Peter Grimes, which was written in 1945, I think. Yes, 1945, and it deals with the idea of isolation from the crowd. So if it's isolation because of his sexual orientation, or if it's isolation because of his being a conscientious objector, which was a small number at that time, there's something very heartfelt about Peter Grimes and the identification with the main character.
All right. Psalms,
yes, yes. And that's a piece that's done in England a lot because it was written for Chichester and for one of the festivals. So that's it's a piece for a large orchestra. It uses psalm texts, obviously. It's in Hebrew. And it also has a nice version. If some of you are in good church choirs but don't have access to the orchestra, there's a chamber version of it for like harp and percussion and organ, I think, entirely. So if you like that piece, and it's quite successful in that form. Anything else about Britten? Let's see, I have a little bit here about commission, if I can find it. Yeah, I had some, here it is, it's at the bottom of the page, sorry. Britain received the commission to write a work for the consecration of the new Coventry Cathedral, which was to be done by May 1962, when they had their festival after the consecration. He was allowed to use any sacred or secular text in a piece 30 to 40 minutes or longer. The piece actually turned out to be an hour and 25 minutes. So quite a bit longer than what they were expecting might happen. The festival committee, however, thought it would cost them nothing because they knew that he was interested in doing it. He had told someone that he was. So I thought, well, good. We've got this famous composer. He's interested. He's going to dedicate this work. Great. We have free work. Does it sound anything like church committees to you? Let's see, we get something for nothing. It will be a nice donation from... And Peter Parrish wrote a rather nice letter, but quite direct, saying, no, it doesn't work that way. You know, for something of this significance and size and amount of effort, and I've turned down three or four commissions already, so I would have time to do this when the commission came. So they relented and gave him £1,000. Which would now be what for us, about $2,000 or $2,500, or is it at right now or 18? And that was supposed to not only pay his commission, but pay for the whole performance. So the pay for the professional soloist and the professional orchestra and all for £1,000. Dreamers, and they thought they were being so generous. Yeah. So eventually, Boosey and Hawks, who wanted to publish the piece and so on, worked out an agreement for them to do it. For more money than that. So I think he at least got the £1,000. He finished the commission in Greece. He went on vacation to Greece. December 20th, 1961. So right before Christmas. The choral parts were shipped off in portions. And this happens often with a brand new work. You don't open up the parts. You open the parts and you get handwritten score. And not the whole piece. You just get portions of it, which you have to eventually... stick together in order to get performed. It received acclaim as a masterwork. Some thought it was not avant-garde enough. Some didn't like it because they thought it imitated Verdi. And there are a few spots that in some aesthetic way remind you of Verdi, but it's certainly not a copying of the themes or anything like that. It does. It's quite an original work, thank you very much. Still other people like Stravinsky has a list, something that he wrote for, I think it was a newspaper, saying too much hype about this piece. So just being kind of, I don't know if he was jealous or what, but he didn't like all the hype that was around it just because of the occasion. And you can't judge a piece of music by what it's intended, how it's intended to move people. You know, he was... For Stravinsky, it was more like solving a problem, you know, that you did this way and made interesting combinations of sounds. And you don't judge it on whether it's a work about the war or something. So he just had, and again, an entirely different view of what art was about. I think are there any people who weren't here last time, last session? Take a look. Do you have a why don't you just hand those out? And on the back side, there's something that says program notes. And why don't you yourselves just read the first paragraph? Because, in a sense, that's what we did yesterday. And obviously, we did have a little more detail than this. But it's essentially sort of what we were discussing. If anyone else wants to review it, now would be the time. I'll give you about 30 seconds, because you're all speed readers anyway. Okay, so we have the old and the new contrasted. We have the idea of forgiveness and reconciliation. We have in the poetry despair and also hope. various places, and we're going to see all of these things reflected in the music. Now we're at the third paragraph. Britten heightens the emotional impact of these images with his music. The chorus and soprano soloist and or large orchestra often represent humankind in its fear, false pride, and groping for help. So they do most of the Latin text. The children, in the case of the original performance, would be, of course, all boys, with organ, usually sing texts of hope and innocence, also from the traditional Latin mass text. And the tenor and baritone with the chamber orchestra sing the poetry of Owen and often represent the combatants. And we talked about in the case of the actual soloists they had, it was the Englishman Peter Pears and the German Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as a baritone. And they become the combatants, talking to one another, leaguing with one another sometimes. The orchestra in its makeup is the traditional symphonic orchestra. And if you think from the top down, you start with, if you're reading a score, and I'll let some of you look at the score in just a minute if you want to. And so if you read down the score, and I'll tell you which parts of the orchestra get expanded a little bit. I suppose he couldn't do too much because of the space constrictions of the cathedral itself. But so you start with three flutes. The third flute can also play piccolo. There are two oboes, an English horn, three clarinets, with the third clarinet sometimes playing bass clarinet when you need more sound down on the bottom, two bassoons, and a double bassoon. Again, so you get more sound on the bottom, so you start hearing, okay, there's this kind of grounding sometimes, or sort of being really dark sound, because you also have the double bassoon. Six horns. The standard in an orchestra is four. Here's six, and you see there's one more in the chamber orchestra. So again, a lot of that sort of rich horn sound. Four trumpets, three trombones, that's the usual, tuba, a piano, organ or harmonium, timpani, and percussion. Percussion you get in here so you can make war sounds, partly. Two side drums, a tenor drum, a bass drum, a tambourine, a triangle, cymbals, castanets, whip, Chinese blocks, gong, bells, vibraphone, glockenspiel, antique cymbals, and then it's the strings. So it's the percussion section that's really expanded, and the horns. Get more horns. Now, in addition, you've got the chamber orchestra. And that's one on a part, so a flute, sometimes playing piccolo, oboe, sometimes playing English horn, clarinet, bassoon, another bassoon, horn and F, and then more percussion. If you do this work, you need lots of percussion equipment. So timpani, side drum, bass drum, cymbal, gong, and then you have a harp in the chamber orchestra, two violins, viola, cello, and double bass, so a string quintet besides. So any questions about that? Voices are large choir, and then the boys separated somewhere else. Three soloists, soprano who's with the choir, the big Russian soprano, Galina Vishnevskaya, and then the two, the tenor and bass that we already talked about. Okay? So that's what we're dealing with in terms of orchestra and choir and the people who are making the sound. Now, we're going to get into the music finally. Does someone want to look at the score? You ready? Okay, good. I should refer you to one page. If you want to look at a page that's just full of, let me see if I can find it here. Anyone, when everyone finally gets going. Oh, here we go. If you look at pages 236 and 237.
Oh,
so if you're doing obviously, if you're the conductor, you're not going to be looking at that for the first time. And you will have done score studies, so you know it's there. Really good musicians will have it in their ears as they're going along. Maybe just use it as a reference point, reminder of what's going on. And when you read the score, you read it all the way across. So it's not like a piano score where you have, you keep going down the page. That's all sounding simultaneously. I'm showing you the most full page.
Well, this isn't the conductor's score, is it?
That's the miniature score of, it's the photograph of the conductor's score.
Which is huge, though.
Well, not huge, actually. It's normal size conductor's score. Sometimes you get a modern piece and it will be huge, where it almost falls over the back of the stand. It's, I would say, maybe just an inch around bigger than this, about like that. This is what's called a piano vocal score. And it has a piano reduction by Imogen Holst, I think. Actually another famous name for English people. And she did the piano reduction. What was I going to tell you? Well, it's a piano vocal score. Oh, I was going to tell you, the chorus has its own parts in small scores, and all they see is their own part. So part of what you have to do when you teach the pieces is help them get in based on what's gone on before. Maybe that's enough sort of practical stuff, because we want to get into hearing some of these basic things about the piece. All right. The most important sound in this whole piece, and it happens throughout the whole Mass, not just here and there, not just a reference or a theme coming back again. It pervades everything except the final reconciliation. In the final reconciliation, you have what's called a pentatonic scale, like playing all the black keys on the piano, you know? And you cannot make a tritone if you use a pentatonic scale. There's no two notes that make that interval. So it's one way that he sort of musically erases that conflict, at least temporarily and for a while, to get a really feeling of resolution. So I'm going backwards. I'm telling you, I just told you the end of the story instead of starting at the beginning and making you grope through and have all these problems. To say that when you finally get to that spot after an hour and 15 minutes where you've had the tritone pervading everything, all of a sudden it disappears. You may not know why it affects you that way, but all the tension has gone out of it, all the musical tension. So the tritone, C and F sharp, this is what he keeps coming back to. So it's like instead of having a key center to the piece, like A major, C major, something like that, you have a tritone. And what's the problem with that? The tritone, it's nasty, it sounds, in the Middle Ages they called it the interval of the devil. You avoided it, you did not do it. It's hard to sing, it sounds ugly. You could not have it if you were a good composer. You avoided it. And
it's
if you
the way
put
they
it.
Tune train horns because it's irritating.
Yeah.
That interval will catch your attention. It's so nasty.
Yeah. Now, being a train buff myself, that's partly true.
It's
true. Some railroads do that. Some do a tritone to be irritating, and some tune to various kinds of thirds or seconds. So it depends what railroad it is, but it does happen. Right.
So some
but, okay.
railroads are up the devil. Yeah. Some aren't.
Yeah, but it is. There's a good reason for doing it to cut through. Also, they're making the horns much louder because people have their windows cranked up, you know, and they're listening to loud music and so on. So they have to crank up the horns so people can hear them. The other ones have all been at rock concerts, so then you have to crank up the horn so the people who are going deaf can hear it. Okay, enough smart aleck remarks. Okay, so he had the interval of the devil, and it's very unstable. So that's also part of it, because it doesn't, you don't know where it's going to go. And here is the sound. Or inverted. Sounds just as bad. So if I even tried to get you to sing it, you'd see that it's hard. So if I have some of you sing this note, and then I'm going to have some of you try to find the tritone above it. Right. So some of you want to go, it kind of wants to sneak up or sneak down. But that is a very sort of disturbing, unstable. Now, there are some resolutions in the piece. The three times it resolves at the end of a movement down to C and F natural. And that is, and makes a beautiful F major chord, again, because you've been hearing it so long with the C and F sharp. And at the end of the first movement, the Requiem, there's a Kyrie eleison, and we will hear that. It resolves there. At the end of the long Dies Irae movement, he resolves it again, and then not until the very end of the piece. And it's basically the same sort of quiet chord progression that comes out of the tritone that happens. Now, so that's three times he resolves it down. At the end of the Agnus Dei, and we'll listen to that, what happens? The text in the Agnus Dei is one of the moments of hope. And it's, you know, what is it that the Christian or the humane person really does with his life? The imitation of Christ is to lay down one's life for one's neighbor, not to take one's life. And so this, and the Dona Nobis Pacem, lifts up to an F sharp and C sharp, so you have a resolution that goes down. Instead of coming to rest, it comes up to hope. All right? And you can hear that even just using simple interval. If it comes from to, that's what he does three times. Two. And at the end of the Agnus Dei, it's, and so just simply that uplift makes a huge change. So that's why one needs to be hearing this all along. Now you can do permutations of this, which means you can do other tritones. You don't have to stay on those two. But those are the ones that keep coming back as kind of a key center. Every movement has those in it. So everything keeps getting grounded on this unstable ground all the way through. Okay? But it can be in different key areas. It can be buried in the harmony. We're going to see right away where it gets buried in this boy's theme, which is going to sound like just kind of a normal tune. And you end up finding out that the tritone is buried in it. And Britten lets you know by eventually making the melody shorter and shorter, and it turns out that the first and the last notes are the C and the F sharp. Well, you don't know that when he goes through a long melody, that he started in C and ended on F sharp. But when you when it gets shorter and shorter, and all of a sudden you say, hey, wait a minute here, and then there it is. And he also keeps it down in the orchestra. And the strings are playing a C and F sharp very quietly behind this. So there are ways he's letting you know that this is going on. Okay, so that's it. Big thing, I'm going to spend the most time talking about the tritone than about any other motif, because it's absolutely essential. It's the thing that you need to hear and keep coming back to. Then we have quintuplets. Okay. What that means is you've got five notes subdividing the beat instead of four or three or two, the normal that we're used to. So sometimes it's within the beat, sometimes it's within the measure. Measure will have five beats instead of two, three, six, four, whatever we're used to. So if you're going one, two, three, four, five, 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 one, two. So he does it in all those different ways with accents on different parts. And you can feel that if you just count with me to five, and then just accent different. We'll start, I'd say, accenting on three. Accent one and three. And then accent one and four. And I'll tell you when to switch. So we'll go one, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. Switch to four.
One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One,
okay?
Two.
So you get that kind of thing going on. Or you'll get one, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One, two, three, four, five. One, two. Where he subdivides the main beat that way. So you can say it with me. Ready?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And you hear that, that's right at the very beginning of the piece. And it's always the measure I had to rehearse the orchestra with the most, because they wanted to square it out to make it come out right. Not that they couldn't read music, but it doesn't feel right to do it that way. And a lot of modern orchestral people are taught to play behind the beat. which is very frustrating because then they're taught to play behind the beat.
Why would they be taught that?
Because some people feel it makes the orchestra have to feel things together, and it gives the conductor a chance to show what he wants to have happen before it actually happens. So you can, if you're a control freak conductor, you can do that until, like, you want accent. If you do that, it goes boom, boom. See, but you've shown what kind of accent that you want, so you have the chance to control. So there's a big that drives me nuts, because I've been taught sort of what I thought was the old-fashioned way, which is to be on the beat. But of course, that's not true. It's not true, especially back in the Romantic period. They probably did a lot of playing off the beat and a lot of not playing together. And that's a 20th century addition to music, to be exactly together like that. This is people like Stravinsky and so on from the early 20th century. So you play exactly what's on the page and nothing different. And if you think, okay, if you hear a wonderful singer, what do? They do not sing what's on the page. They change certain notes to make it expressive. Yeah. So there's some element of that. I'm defending the thing that I hate. Because you asked me why did they do it. Because you can sometimes get a more expressive, but it's a lot, often less clean. Yeah. And especially on a piece where you need to be together, and when you've got disparate groups and it's very large, I think it's a real dangerous thing to do, to have people respond behind the beat. It can get to be a mess, and the piece can get slower and slower. That's the other bad thing about that. Okay, we're stumbling around now, aren't we? So I think it's that sort of thing. So you've got the destabilized here with the tritone. Now you've got it rhythmically destabilized by measures of five and sometimes subdivision of the beat into five. Okay, and again, that happens all through the piece. You're going to hear it over and over and over again, these destabilizing things. Now, we already talked about the boys' theme, but I want to play it for you just to show you how clever and almost deceitful it is. Okay, so here are the boys. It sounds like kind of a nice tune, modern, you know, it has some chromaticism a little bit. By that time, he's gone through 11 of the 12 notes of the chromatic scale. In other words, he's made it like what was called 12-tone serial music. There's a little reference to that, where you have to use all the notes of the chromatic scale right before you come back and return to one. And then he takes it and he turns it upside down. Supporting the tune with harmonies, but we're going to find that he's prefiguring this here, the ascending scale, by that those chords going up and doing. We're going to see. So in the first movement, there are going to be bits of these things that we're going to talk about also, prefiguring of them, and that's one thing, that sort of scale going up in the organ part. Right. So the melody gets shorter and shorter. Pretty soon it's doing something like this. All right, and then it does this. Oh ho, now it's starting to be, you're starting to hear that. And pretty soon they go, okay, and then we're back to the tritone. Yeah. And then the chorus comes in with it. So here the choir is singing Requiem Aeternam, grant us rest, O Lord, or give them rest, etc. And it's all on the tritone. The only thing the choir gets to sing until the Kyrie, the only thing, are C and F sharps. That's all they have. orchestra's doing other things, very rich harmonies. The boys get their theme, but in the prayer for rest, there's no rest. There's only a tritone. Okay? And then we get to the Kyrie eleison at the end of the movement is treated very simply, with straightforward chord progressions, a cappella in the choir. But every time the choir comes in, it starts with, guess what? Yeah, and then he moves into another progression, and then the bells strike again, right? And then you have the choir starts there, and then finally the choir moves to that F major chord, the first resolution, finally. So the Kyrie, they get to sing a few more notes, so they can make a chord progression. But otherwise, they keep coming back to that. And if those bells keep chiming here and there in the movement, you're going to hear them coming back again and again to that sort of thing. What passing bells for those who die as cattle? Well, there is some of that sense for them. I'd like to play you the first movement. I might talk over the top of it just a little bit. But do you have any questions about it? I think we have time to do that and also get in the next set that we'll listen to tomorrow in the second movement. I mean, this almost all feels like an introduction, and this feels like now we've started the symphony. Now we've started the main movement, because this is a much more sort of intensely structured. And this feels like you're just sort of wandering around and groping around trying to figure what is this all about? Just like a good introduction to classical symphony, the slow movement, what? It avoids getting to the key. It finds ways of staying unstable until, bing, the main theme comes in. So that's what we're doing, is kind of the introductory, even though it's very important and sets up the whole work. It has a feeling of being, not quite settled. Okay. So gong in the very low part of the orchestra. Bells. And the choir is mumbling, and they're supposed to be mumbling. Sings the same rhythm on the Requiem. It's always slightly different. Now it's triplets.
Light is that? What kind of light?
bottom note in Yorkshire is mainly an A, which if you put in here makes a diminished triad, which is still unstable. Boys. So the tritone, you really sort of don't hear it. So he keeps, one voice part goes one way and the other goes the opposite, what we call inversion. And the whole thing just starts kind of disintegrating. You almost feel enough already. Yeah, let me out of here. It's a nightmare already. You can't get anywhere. The choir keeps coming back. Here's Light Perpetual coming again. It's almost time for the soloist to come in. So watch for that text now.
And this is Pierce.
This would be Pierce, yes. You're going to hear those instruments used as sounds of war, as whistling, ammunition, so on, coming up. Drawing down the blinds. bells again, doing the C and F sharp. It's written B sharp, but it's the same as C. Well, that's the point in the concert where you hope someone doesn't slap a mosquito. But John, you get the sense that fight, when it comes to that quiet resolution, it's such a blessed relief, right? Okay, so that's the first movement. Usually you won't have someone talking above it like I was. But if you can come that last day, on the Friday we're going to do a play through the complete thing, I might mention something between movements at the most, so that you get a sense of what the whole work feels like as an aesthetic whole piece, and not pulled apart into little bits like I'm doing today.
Bob, you didn't say anything, but how devout was he?
How devout is Britain?
Mm-hmm.
Not devout. He's more sort of typical British in that he knows the liturgical tradition and he understands very well what Christianity is all about and what Christmas is all about. That's why he can write a wonderful ceremony of carols, even if he sort of doesn't believe the theology that lies behind it. But he knows the tradition and he knows what needs to be said and he knows the right emotion. So we had a tenor at St. Ulf who sang the St. Matthew Passion of Bach and did the evangelist part for that, which is sort of the center of the whole thing. If you're going to deliver that piece, you better have a good Jesus, for one thing, but you need a good person to do the evangelist, and he did, but he was not a believer. But you would never know it, because he plugged into the humanity of what was going on, rather than the theology. And in the art that works partly because music, you cannot really say what it's about. Now, I'm going to tell you what I think these things are about, but Britain never says it, so I don't really know. And he didn't write about it. But I think it's what I bring to it, you know. And I think it'll make sense to you people also. And it helps me as I listen to it. But I can't say, you know, this means this.
So his pacifism was not a result of his theology, but his worldview.
Yeah, his worldview. And I suppose he would say, how can you Christians not be pacifists,
right,
based on what's
yeah.
in the Bible?
Yeah.
You know, I may not be a believing Christian in terms of Christ as my personal savior, and therefore I'll go to heaven, which is sort of the standard by which some people, conservatives, measure whether you're Christian or not. So, I mean, he would be Christian in the sense of how does a Christian play out into society and work in society, you know, that sense of it. But it would be interesting to talk about the whole Episcopalian theology and work in England and how the church has gotten to be, not for devout people necessarily, but only for very few, even though it's the state church. They charge you now to go into some of the big cathedrals. So if you're going to go into King's, the first time we went over and were in England, the place we stayed was right not too far from King's. So if I'd go downtown or go to study, I'd come back and just drop in at King's and look out a window or just sort of get that experience. It was sort of a blessing just to walk in the place. And then the last time we went, you know, it was this many pounds, you know, a pound or 5 pounds or whatever, to go in and just look at the place. You still didn't have to pay to go into the services. But if you're going to go any other time of day, like I was just dropping in, then it cost you as a tourist. Okay. The second, we're going to have time to do these four main themes that appear in the second movement. The first, now, if you resolve this thing, we said it had an A in it, in the bottom of the orchestra, A, F sharp, and C, and if resolve it down to C, F, A, and C here, you get just an ordinary triad. It's an ordinary thing. So you can do a trumpet or a bugle call using that kind of resolved. That. Or. Right. And so I've called that either the call to judgment in the Mass, or the call to go out and do battle. The bugle call, saying, okay, troops, get ready. Now we're ready to do our work, which is to kill people. So you've got either facing the final judge, or you have judgment, or you have facing battle coming up. And so he uses it both ways. And sometimes he makes it go into kind of a minor chord instead of major, when it's really a sad call, the bugle's calling, and you know the person's going to be killed, very, very sad. And then he'll make another kind of combination of notes that resemble this trumpet call, but actually he's moved the intervals a little bit to make it feel sadder to most people. All right, and then you get the horn call. Well, that's like this. But mostly, so what does that remind you of, if you hear horns doing that, doing a fourth? What? Yeah, the hunting. And that's what I think. I think he's using it, and it's a French horn, which is a hunting horn, and it plays mostly the fourth. And the fourth, you can get out of this by resolving it down this way. So you have F sharp, and the C, if you take the C down to a B, this is a fourth. And what I played you was just a half step lower than that, but it was even about there. So you've got the call to hunting out there in the field, or is it called hunting the other guy who's across the line that you want to shoot and kill? So he, again, uses it both ways. So there it is. Now you get a descending scale and an ascending scale. So you get this. Asymmetrical goes down. So it's times when he's talking about descent, it can be descent to hell, you know, it can be any kind of a descent, that where the calls are going down the scale, and then you can go the opposite direction, and it can be hope, it can be lifting up the big artillery gun, something. So you've got upward moving scales, and again, there's a tritone buried in that scale, so it is not it's not major or minor, or not one of the medieval modes, even. It's a scale that he's made up that contains the tritone. All right. So it can go down, it can actually have some hope. And then you've got the final Dies Irae melody that the choir begins to sing, and that returns in the orchestra in the last movement at the Great Cataclysm. You get the orchestra playing it. But it's this. So instead of dies ire, dies ila, it's dies ire, dies ila. Sol, vet, seclum, in, fa, vila, dum, 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 dum. You know, and he picks it up in the brass, and you get these themes start picking up and doing their things, and he superimposes the one on top of the other. And so you get the first view of the final judgment, or going to the great battle, or the next war to come, as Owen says in one of his poems, which would be the Second World War, or worse. So let's listen to the very opening of this second, and he presents the themes in this order that I've given them to you here. Let me see if I got the right. Tuba solo coming up. Now the descent again. Call. built on this.
No, reversed upside down. Left is A, which makes another tritone. All right, now get the next section. Soprano comes in first time. Come in a little bit, but it's not his theme or anything. Okay, so we will pick it up there tomorrow and do the rest of the Dies Irae and the offertory, probably through the Abraham and Isaac poem.